This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real life store stage, all the way to the, hey Marge, did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify is there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Running a growing business means getting the insights you need wherever you are. With Shopify's single dashboard, you can manage orders, shipping, and payments from anywhere. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States, and Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/ifanboy, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/ifanboy now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/ifanboy.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This is iFanboy Pick of the Week 845, brought to you by iFanboy listeners just like you. Hello, welcome to iFanboy Pick of the Week, episode 845. My name is Connor Kilpatrick, and this is my co-host, Josh Flanagan.
That is me. That's right. I am that guy.
I looked down, and I noticed there's an eyelash on my microphone, and it's going to bug me, but if I take it off, you're all going to hear it.
Is it another man's eyelash?
It might be.
Someone bitten.
Somebody else is podcasting in my house.
It is some other kind of really bad podcast. Right. I used to have an answer for what that is, but now I don't. It's probably just two dudes sitting around talking about their opinions on some shit they're not qualified. Oh, crap.
It's like a super macho podcast about bodybuilding.
I get served Instagram reels about that kind of thing, and mm-hmm. I don't know how to make it stop.
We got to stop posting gym videos.
I don't feel like I tag it or anything. There's nothing that would say that.
The machine knows, Josh.
It totally does. But one of them was like, listen, you should only deadlift if what you want to do is deadlift. You go into professional sports and you don't see anybody deadlifting. And I was like,
wait a minute, have you been podcasting in my house?
Yeah, it was me. Also, I'm fucking ripped now. I'm so swole.
So we are iFanboy, and believe it or not, every week we read a bunch of comics and one of us picks their favorite book, called that the pick of the week. We'll talk about that book. We'll talk about other books for the week. We talk about the patron pick. We try to have some listener mail time, and I think we're going to have it this week. I'm not guaranteeing it, but no comics came out, so I'm hoping we're going to have listener mail time. Here's your spoiler warning. This is a review show. Actually, I have some caution. So, Josh, you had to pick this fifth week in which hardly any comics came out. So, good luck.
I managed to tack some together, and luckily this pick of the week has 8 stories in it. So, I mean, we could really... really run this out. Pick of the week is Amazing Fantasy number 1000. Amazing Fantasy number 15 was the first appearance of Spider-Man way back in 1962? 3?
And then, let's see, 945 issues later, here we are.
Yeah. I
think we should point out before you dig into these mini stories is that okay. this is a totally made-up number. I mean, this is not like... they took all the Spider-Man issues and added them together. This is just made up. This is Spider-Man's 60th anniversary. And so This is what they did.
And if you don't know that, it makes it even better. So I actually saw this, and for some reason I thought it was a like a reprint. I thought it was something that had already happened before. Actually, if you look on the title page, that's a terrible, really boring cover. I think probably why I thought that, because it looks like a reprint.
The cover is boring, but I like the drawing.
Yes, I agree with you. But and then when you go to the inside, the font that they use is the Fantastic Four font, but also the iFanboy font. An amazing fantasy number.
Which we should be clear, we've licensed.
Yes, we did.
But yes, well, why? Well, I guess, you know, Fantastic Four font really is kind of Marvel's font, so I guess that's what it is.
Sure. I was like, this looks like one of our things. Yep. I thought it was a reprint. Then you said it's in the running for patron pick. Yep. And I went, oh, I guess I have to read it. And then I realized, like, it's long. I was like, oh, no. Straight away, first thing, I actually read, like, late last night, I read the first story, and I was like, I'll get to the rest of it tomorrow, because it was the only thing I had left to read.
Mm-hmm.
But that first story, I was like, oh, this is pretty great. It was just some guy. It was called by Anthony Falcone and Michael Cho, art by Michael Cho, whose art you do not see sequentially very much. I've seen a lot of pinup work from him. Great artist.
He's a great Instagram follow.
Yeah. But it's like this really charming little story about this just one guy who has Paulie Walnuts haircut. And he has a tracksuit, and he's like a thief, and he keeps getting caught by Spider-Man. And what's great is that, like, he ages over the years, and you're like, isn't Spider-Man supposed to be 80 here? And you're like, let it go. Doesn't matter.
Let it go.
But it was super, super charming and fun. And I mean, Michael Cho's art is wonderful. Yeah. He's vaguely related to a Darwin Cook school, but
they're both from Canada.
Yeah.
And, you know,
he's got his own pop art feel.
One of Darwin's, as Darwin was dying, as he was, you know, he was sick and knew he wasn't going to make it. His friends would come over and draw with him, you know, like All Red and people like that. They'd come over and they would sketch, and he kept taking not commissions, but like jobs, like covers and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Even though he knew he was sick and dying, and somebody asked him why he used to keep taking jobs, and he said, "Well, I can't let Michael Cho get everything," because he knew that this was the kind of like the next guy in that school.
Yeah. You know?
So he was holding Michael Cho off with a stick.
That's really good. So I get to the second story, and it's Dan Slott, Jim Chung, J. David Ramos on colors, Josephino. Josephino lettered most of this, but whatever. And it's, I expected nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And what you've got is Spider-Man here. Jim Chung, another guy who's just amazing, who doesn't do a lot of interiors anymore, but, you know, like, when he does, they're super special.
Yes.
And so I remember one time we ran into him at Comic-Con, and he said hi to us, and I guess he knew the show or whatever, and I was like, do you want to be on it? He's like, no. Just completely uninterested in talking to me about it.
A lot of artists do that. A lot of artists don't talk.
It wasn't a big-time thing. He's like, I just don't want that to be part of my thing.
I was just explaining to the people that over the years, back when we did do interviews at cons, we mostly talk to writers because mostly writers like to hear themselves talk, and a lot of artists are shy.
So I always think of that, and then, but when I see his art, I'm always really happy. And this is actually a little more, I love the way that he draws Spider-Man in this, but it's because we find out this is Spider-Man's 60th birthday.
Yeah.
And a woman who we can assume is Mary Jane, but it's a little hard to tell because he doesn't say her name, and she has gray hair.
And no
dimples.
He's
waiting for him. But I like that choice. Like, they aged her, and that's what would happen to her hair, and that's kind of cool. And he gets in this fight, you know, and she's like, you're always late on your birthday. He's like, I know. And then he's like, I promise I'll be right there. And then he hears somebody else calls for help. So he goes and helps that person, and like Omar Little, a kid shoots the shit out of him.
Right.
And he ends up in the hospital, and they don't know who to call, and Mary Jane sees it on the news, so she gets there. But there's a big line of people who are there to thank Spider-Man for all the things that he's done over the year. And again, he's an old man, but he looks great, by the way.
Well, he's in good shape. The spider helps. But yeah. I did like that there were all these little things, like the EMT guy and the doctor. They're all like, no, we don't take his mask off.
Like, yeah, no, I like that.
Spider-Man.
They totally respected him. I think it's really funny that, like, it's totally unrealistic that, like, there's a line around people around the block and they let them in.
Sure.
But it didn't matter.
What kind of germs could they have? Or infections. Who cares?
But it doesn't matter.
You go.
Because it was super sweet. And
well, this is the story, Josh. By the time I read this, and by the time I got to this one, I was like, okay, so.
Oh yeah.
If this isn't the pick of the week.
But that was it. Like I read this story, and I went, well, that's the pick of the week. It was. I mean,
this
all
is such a love letter to Spider-Man. This comic. I mean, obviously, that's what it's designed to be. But Jesus Christ, this is a terrific.
It was, and he did it in 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 pages, pages.
I mean, the whole thing was a love letter.
Right? No, I know, but like this story specifically was the thing that ticked me over into the column. It was just this story. If I read one comic that was 10 pages and it was this story, I would have made it pick of the week.
You're on the Dan Slott train now.
I don't, man, this is when she finds him in the hospital, like I got misty. I was like, holy shit. Like I really felt it. And you know, the fact that I also thought up until like the last page, I thought they killed him. I was like, Jesus.
But then it was a great joke. I mean, you know, they hear the machine go ee in the flat line, and you go, and he's not dead. He's jumped out the window to stop a mugging in his gown. And anyone who's been in the hospital worn one of those gowns knows there's no coverage. So there's Spider-Man's 60-year-old ass flopping in the wind during the. I thought that was very funny.
It was great. It was just a joyful story, and it's like, oh my goodness, they survive. And he still does his thing, and that makes me feel good for some reason, you know. And they're still together, and you get that. We'll go through the rest of the story. That was really the one, though. The Sinister 60.
The first two.
And there
there were two that I skimmed.
Okay, so Spider-Man versus the Conspiraton was written by Armando Iannucci, who is. One of my favorite TV writers of all time. He showrun Veep. He wrote the I'm Alan Partridge TV show, which is one of my favorite things I've ever watched. He did In the Loop. He's done a bunch of stuff. And it was fine. Ryan Stegman, the art, really just kicked ass on this, I thought. Was great.
Yeah, it was an interesting idea that there was this thing that made everyone see the Daily Bugle however they wanted to see it.
Right.
So like, all, but you know.
It was a comment on media.
Yeah,
and
it was fine.
And what I think that what happens is sometimes you'll have a quote-unquote celebrity person come in and they're like, I'm going to tackle this issue. And I was like, you don't need to.
Just tell a Spider-Man story.
Just tell a Spider-Man story. Everybody is tackling these issues all the time. And they're doing it more subtly. This is a thing that happens a lot. And like, it was funny or whatever, but it wasn't great. I thought Ryan Stegman really did a great Spider-Man. He's made for that guy. You have a really fun rainbow role, Olivia Coipel, Matthew Wilson story, which was really fun to read, and I liked it an awful lot, but also was the one the whole time that I was like, this art, this combination of art and color is sublime.
Oh, beautiful. Like, I love Olivia Coipel, but Matthew Wilson coloring Olivia Coipel, I was like, give me this.
Oh my God. It's every frame of this is beautiful.
The first page is just him sitting on the roof eating a pistachio ice cream. And I was just like, yes.
And it's a great short story, one note gag. Yep. And it's totally Spider-Man, but it's out of left field.
But I had a lot of great character stuff. You know, this is back when he's young, he's dating Betty Brant. And then there's a bit where, you know, nothing's going on in the city. There's no crimes. So Peter goes around taking artistic shots of the city and people like in the summertime and like, you know, New York in the summer, and he gives them to Jonah. Jonah's like, what the fuck is all this? I don't want any of this shit. He wants Spider-Man pictures. But then Robbie picks it up at the very end and says, let's clear some space. Like, Robbie recognizes Peter's talent. Like, it was all, it had all great character bits within like the five pages of whatever it was.
Mm-hmm. That double page spread where Jonah yells at him. Mm-hmm. Look at the movement on that. The pages and the pictures are flying everywhere as he swings them. He's yelling, so you've got motion lines coming out of his mouth. All of the stuff up in the air isn't really supposed to be the pictures, you know, like flying, but it represents that. Yeah. Peter is leaning back a little bit from it. It's just.
But he's also used to it. Like, he's not freaking out.
I just mean like the motion of the thing.
No, I'm just saying there's so much goodness, good stuff in here.
And the word balloons follow it up through, so you get to read everything. I mean, that is one hell of a page. I keep going back to it. Like, this art, and I like the art in the rest of it totally, but that one was extra special.
Yes.
We have this story here by Hochi Anderson. I don't know who this is. Didn't really like it.
That was one of the ones I skimmed. I was like,
Giuseppe Camuncoli art, and he was actually Spider-Man artist for a long time. A weird little story that ended up being kind of charming. was Slaves of the Witch Queen by Kurt Busiek and the Dodsons. And the idea was that in the old days, comic books had two bits. That's why it was called Amazing Fantasy, because there'd be a front story and a back story.
Yep.
And this is a continuation of the second story in that that didn't have anything to do with Spider-Man, as I understand it.
Yeah, that, and once I figured that out, I was like, okay, Kurt, you're being cute.
He was, and I was annoyed by it, but then by the time I got to the end of it, I really liked it.
It was
liked
a good
the
story,
idea.
And Dodsons are great, and Kurt's a yep. great writer, but at first I was like, come on, this is the Spider-Man comic, not the cute comic.
I had the same thing, but I was like, he pulled it off. Like, he got me within those few pages, came around. You got a Jonathan Hickman story, which I loved.
It was
I
great.
Loved
Marco
this
Cicchetto.
Jonathan.
It was terrific.
Yep. Like, it's this council of Spider-Mans, and they fuck with him, and I totally believed it. And they all start laughing. It was brilliant.
They all made Peter think that he was the only fuck-up Spider-Man in the universe. They all had their lives together. They all had great lives, and they were rich and happy, and Peter's like, oh, fuck, I'm the only screw-up Spider-Man in the whole multiverse? And they're like, no, we're just kidding. We're all fucked.
But you, like, three of the five pages were them fucking with us.
It was good. And then look at that final drawing from Marco Cicchetto, Spider-Man jumping.
Yep.
And this was a tour de force comic.
Great color. Great color on that one, too.
Yeah. That's, we should mention, that's Frank Martin. Great stuff.
Finally, you've got, I wrote Steve McNiven, but it's Neil Gaiman with great power. And this is really more of an autobiographical thing. Because when Neil Gaiman says he wanted to do a thing, you put it in your book.
Yeah.
Really interesting Steve McNiven art. I couldn't have told you this was
him. Oh, yeah, great Steve McNiven art.
You know, and it basically tells the story of, you know, young British lad from Sussex, who's clearly Neil Gaiman, you know, finding Spider-Man, but that Spider-Man comes and talks to him, and mixing reality and fantasy. And then we cut to the future where, it's funny because he doesn't name Jonathan Ross, but it's Jonathan Ross when they go to Ditko to try to meet him, and it doesn't work out.
Jonathan Ross made a documentary about Ditko.
Yeah, Searching for Ditko or something like that.
Yeah.
And I've seen this little clip of the two of them, but this is sort of the part that you didn't get to see. But also in this, there's the fantasy of actually Spider-Man being in there and pretending like he doesn't
know. Magical realism, right? That's what Neil Gaiman does. And so Spider-Man is like a character in his life. And I've seen, I'm a huge fan of him. Not necessarily all of his work, but him as a person and a writer. I've seen him speak twice in my time living in LA, and one of them was fairly recently. And he talked a lot in that one about his childhood fandoms. And he's a huge Batman and Spider-Man fan. Like, he just loves those characters. And the little bit here about him as a kid reading Spider-Man comics and Spider-Man showing up and being real and losing the Spider-Man toy, and that was the whole button on the story. Like, I thought this was a terrific story.
I gotta say, by the way, if you're gonna talk about something that brings me back, is that he got an iron-on patch out of the magazine, and I was like, oh shit, that did used to be a thing. And he put it on his shirt and he wore it out, and I was like, I did that. And it was a thing. Like, it does not exist anymore.
Nope.
And I don't want to turn this into two old men reminiscing, but as like a thing that puts you in a time and place, and I could smell it. I could tell what it felt like under my fingers. I thought it was really cool.
And then there was one more story we didn't put in the script that was written by Mike Pasquiolo, who was he was a Marvel marketing VP, and he had pitched a book, and they didn't do it, but they had Todd Nowak draw part of it for this, and it was, you know, it was okay. I hate to say it, criticize, but this is one of the ones I kind of skimmed. I was like, I don't really. But
it wasn't very long. It was just
nice,
a few pages.
You know, nice to put him in the book to sort of put him alongside these big names. I finished this up and I was like, God damn it! This is why I love superhero comics. Like, this issue was like all of the joy that you find reading these books was in this issue.
I don't know exactly why, but a lot of these sort of anniversary issues, made up or not, you know, they'll just take a bunch of people and they put stuff in it. And it's usually like, it's great, and then it kind of falls off. But this character has such traction, and, you know, people want to do it. And, you know, for the most part, you know, the quality was very high here compared to other anthology type issues like this.
And the thing is, this is what all anniversary comics used to be, which I loved. I love these anthologies, but now with the trades, they have to sort of keep them in the story. You know, you can't be having a collected edition. All of a sudden, in the middle of it, you've got a 40-page anthology. So there's always like one story that has to be in continuing things on. So it feels less special. This feels like the comics used to be, and I really liked it.
Yeah, it was super enjoyable. And like I said, as soon as I read that Dan Slott story, I was like, that's enough. If this doesn't fall off the cliff, then I don't know. And when I looked back at the other books, and it's like,
well, the first
I got
back
nothing.
To back, like the first two, yep. like were strong out the gate. And then, you know, the third one's okay. Then Rainbow Rowell, again, strong. And then, okay. And then three strong ones. It was like, wow, okay. Yeah. I was really happy reading it.
And it was just, you know, it was your love letter to Spidey thing. But yeah, for me, like the Just Some Guy story was really fun and cute and whatever. You know, Sinister Six, you threw me over the top. Mm-hmm. Olivia Coipel and Rainbow Rowell, you know, just, it's just so many good things in here.
It was nice to see Rainbow Rowell in with all these heavy hitters.
Oh, yeah.
I'm hoping she gets, I mean, I didn't read The Runaways, but I did, I've you know, read some of her, some things here and there, and then you talk to her. Like, I'm hoping she gets to do as much as she wants to, because clearly she's very, very good at writing
oh,
comics.
Yeah. She's a Marvel kid.
Yeah.
And so she's got
if
it.
She
she's
wants
only going
to
get better.
Give her more work.
Yep.
I say.
So there's your pick of the week.
Rainbow, give me 10%. I read Thunderbolts number one. I wasn't planning on it, but nothing came out this week, so I was like, all right, I'll try Thunderbolts number one. It's a 5-issue miniseries written by Jim Zub with art by Sean Isaacs, who had done the Fantastic Four book with Mark Russell that we really liked.
Okay.
He's a good artist.
Yeah. Okay.
I had forgotten, looked at the cover, and I was like, okay, I don't really know who most of these people are on the cover other than Hawkeye, and what the fuck is he wearing? Although it's closer to his old suit.
Oh, I thought, okay, at least that's mostly Hawkeye. That's what I thought.
We're going to get to that, the costume, in a second. I don't hate the costume. I just like, what's going on? I had forgotten that this is sort of tying into the whole Daredevil story in which Wilson Fisk was the mayor, and then he was deposed, and then Luke Cage became mayor. And while Wilson Fisk was the mayor, he made the Thunderbolts his sort of his squad of super enforcers. They were all villains. And so now Luke is back. Luke briefly also led the Thunderbolts in their 2000s. So Luke calls on Clint to say, Clint, come run my Thunderbolts team. It's the only team of superheroes allowed in New York, which is silly and stupid, but whatever. We'll take it as the idea. And you guys are going to sort of clean up the city. And so that's the basic concept of, so they're like a government-sponsored team.
The other bit of it is also a marketing push, and so there's like a consultant person who's like, no, you gotta have this person on the team for this. Yep. You know, it's built this way, they're trying to work on the image. And you know, Luke's thing was like, well, you know,
it's not an organic team, it's a team from put together by a marketing firm.
And then the other thing is that he's like, you were my guy, you're the first person I chose, and he wasn't. Monica Rambeau was the first one,
right.
And I actually remember in one of the issues he'd mentioned that it's dysfunctional team, get them back together. This is hot. This is Clint Barton in here. I'm going
to
give him that.
I wanted to ask you, because so not only are you Clint guy, but you were also a Thunderbolts guy. For people who don't know, like you love the original book is one of your favorite all-time books, and like you love that Thunderbolts book. So I liked it. You loved it. So I was curious to see what you thought of this Clint. Is this more of a Clint, or is this more of a Hawk guy situation? Or
I thought it's a nice melding, but I definitely saw Clint here. He's like a little older. He's trying to get the band back together. He's like, we should do West Coast Avengers again.
Oh,
and
I love that.
I was like, I buy that. And so then this came up, and he's like, all right, we'll do that. And he's like, I'll call up Vish and Wanda, Wonder Man. You know, it's like, no, that's not what this is. I dug that. It's a little, he's a little down and out, or he's just trying to figure out where he lands next. And, you know, been through this. It's the same Hawkeye that we recognize from the other stuff. He's just trying to be somewhere. One of the things I like about Thunderbolts is that it's proven to be a really malleable concept. I can think of a few different versions of it. There was during Secret Invasion, there was they were all villains who were playing as the heroes. So like Hawkeye was Bullseye, and I forget the others, but
it is a very elastic concept.
Yeah, I think it really works that way. It's a little like Suicide Squad in a way. And then but there's always that hero villain thing going on.
That's the constant.
And you know, like Clint Barton was a villain in his first appearance, barely, but that was the deal.
Although I guess here there isn't real.
No, I know, but we don't know yet. I mean, that's the thing. So famously, the end of the first issue of the first Thunderbolts, or maybe, I don't even know if it was the second issue, because this week also, they released a Thunderbolts collection, and I read the first couple of Busick Bagley issues. just because I wanted to.
That's right, it was Bagley. I forgot about that.
Yeah, and as far as Bagley, I knew. And you know, it's great. It's super sort of fun, and there's no giveaway. There's a couple little giveaways in it if you know what's going to happen. But when you turn to that last page, it was a total surprise that they were actually supervillains. And I have to assume that, I mean, I guess I don't have to assume, but if you're doing this, I would try to put that in here somewhere. There has to be some big reveal if something isn't what you think it is.
So the team is ostensibly led by Clint, although Luke tells Monica, yeah, you're kind of the leader, really.
Yeah.
So it's Clint and Monica sort of co-leading this team with America Chavez, the new Power Man, which I forgot was a thing.
One of
Kilgrave's daughters, who is apparently now like 27. Like, how did that, like, they were all just kids.
That's a great, but she's a great one because she's
like, a good addition. She's a chaotic element. And then there's two other characters who I don't.
One of them is like,
no. One's like Cable.
Yeah, like Cable, but they won't tell him what his power is. And I'm like, well, that doesn't make any sense. He wouldn't tell
the guy.
Everything
about him is classified.
Right. It's a gag.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not the biggest fan of Jim Zub. It tends to be a little milk toast for me.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought this was pretty well done. I don't think it was the greatest book ever, but I had fun reading it. I'll read the next one.
I always find, I mean, I know it's the thing, but like at this point, I feel like new heroes shouldn't be looking down on Clint.
I agree with that.
I feel like old heroes, that's like when you and I bust balls. But like, yeah. I feel like new guys in the scene shouldn't be making fun of Hawkeye.
Yeah,
a guy who was the founder of the Avengers, the West Coast Avengers, and et cetera, et cetera.
But I want you to think about somebody who's 22 years old, and if they would respect somebody who's, you know, 45 and has been doing something for 20 years.
Right.
Would they really? No, they wouldn't. They would be like, whatever, old man. And he doesn't even have to be that old for them to say whatever, old man. It's okay, boomer, if you're over 35.
True.
So I buy that. It was good.
I had the same feeling as you. It was okay. Like, I didn't dislike it. I'd probably read the whole thing because it's a miniseries. I like this hybrid suit that Hawkeye's wearing.
I mean, it's better than the t-shirt.
I mean, he's not wearing jeans and a t-shirt. But I don't understand why Hawkeye doesn't get to wear a mask anymore. I just think it's weird.
I don't know.
And I know that's like an old idea, but I just really like Hawkeye. I always liked Hawkeye's mask, but, you know, I feel like superheroes should be running around without a mask on.
Yeah, things, you know, movies.
And I know why they do it, but just if you're going to go 90% of the way and give him a suit again, give him a mask.
Fair enough. He's golfing at the beginning. we had Superman War World Apocalypse number one. This is the end of the story that's been going on in Action Comics. For some reason, went into this one shot to finish the whole thing up.
Who knows?
I don't mind this story, but as I was reading this, I was like, you know, I've read every issue of this, and I didn't know who the fuck anybody was except for Mongol, Midnighter, and Superman. Like,
and
not
Apollo.
I think so.
And Manchester Black.
Yeah, but you know, what I know who he is, but when he was on the page, I didn't know who he was until somebody said his name. Oh, that's him. And like something had happened with Apollo where he'd been taken over. And I didn't, like, nothing about this story stuck. Now, when I was reading it, I wasn't like, this is no good. I don't know what's going on. It's just at the end here, I was like, well, I've completely lost the thread because I basically just watched it for the character moments that I knew. Superman was very consistent through the whole thing. Philip Kennedy Johnson's a great writer. And, but like, there's a villain, there's a turn here. One of the people who has been the good guy all along turns out to have been a traitor, but not really. Actually, I liked that last part, the way that they handled it. But when he turned, I was like, I don't have no idea who that is. I've never seen that character in my life.
I think that happened in the last issue of Action, to turn.
I've read every one of them.
Yeah, you and I read every one of these, and I really liked the first half of this story.
Yeah.
And remember when they had that artist who was sort of like a Conan artist?
Yeah.
Like, he was sort of like very sketchy and looked very sort of 70s Conan the Barbarian. Like, that was when the story was really interesting. That guy went away. I was hoping he'd come back for this issue, but he didn't. Or at least part of it, because this issue had three artists, Brandon Peterson, or four artists, Will Conrad, Max Rayner, Miguel Mendoza. And by the end, I think I was in the same boat you were. I was like, okay, I was sort of just getting, like, get this over with. Like, I was just, like, get, this is all fine and good. Mongol gets killed, which happens a lot.
There was a great issue. Is that the one that guy drew that you're talking about? The one where it's, like, the story of Mongol
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
And like, it's their world and how the Warzoon behave, mm-hmm. and his mother, is all that. I think that was that one. That was great.
This is just a story that went on. It went on about 5 issues too long.
Probably. I think it was well done. I just
It was not bad. I just by the end of it, I was like, okay. Like, there was a lot of water treading.
I think that because there wasn't consistent art, it was difficult to tell who was going. It was very frenetic. Like, it was honestly, in this one, I just thought, wow, I don't know the thread, but it's actually a really simple story, which leads open the question then. It's like, so what happens now?
Well, that's how the story ends, and Kal-El has returned. He's back, not only back on Earth, he's young again. His hair is all black, unless he's dying it.
I think they're going to drop that part of it.
They have to. I mean, look, I'm zooming in. His hair's all black. Someone should tell him he's lost his job in the meantime. He went on a very long vacation, and while he was gone, a younger, cheaper employee was hired to take his position.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll see. But I'm happy. Like, the story was fine overall. I'm happy he's back.
I liked that. I think what I would get at is that it was a valid attempt, although not all successful, at doing a Superman story in a different context. Superman through there. At no point did you go, this isn't Superman. He was Superman through the whole thing. That's what held it all together, I think.
And we said for a while it was a very good Elseworlds story. And that's at its height, that's what it was.
It doesn't even have to be that, though. The
tone of it was, like Superman, the Barbarian on a planet where he had no powers. Like, that's kind of what the story was. And it was interesting for a while.
John Carter of Mars. Too long.
So I was talking to you today, and we were talking about how light the week was and what we were going to put in the show, and you were like, just read G.I. Joe.
G.I. Joe,
Real American Hero 297. Read it.
Right.
And so I got it, and I scrolled through 15 covers, and I got to the opening, and it said part two. I was like, oh, cool. I'll jump into a part two of a story. That's fun. And then it says, the final G.I. Joe Real American Hero story arc at IDW Publishing continues. And I went, well, shit, hold on.
I didn't know that. I don't think I saw that part.
So I was like, well, this is Larry Hama writing the final arc at IDW. This is kind of like the end of G.I. Joe as we know it since we were in kindergarten.
Okay, so for a backstory, Larry Hama did 155 issues of G.I. Joe at Marvel.
Yes.
They are awesome. They are awesome. They are so much better than you think that they would be. Mark Bright... Or M.D. Bright drew a lot of it.
All kinds of great artists. But the point is, this IDW run was the continuation of that Marvel run. So I thought, okay.
142 issues continuation, by the way.
This is a big deal. So what I did was I went back and I got the previous issue, 296. Because I thought, well, if this is the final arc, I should probably read the whole arc. So I read 296 and 297 today. This one is Larry Hama. They feature different artists. Andrew Lee Griffith and Nethro Diaz were the artists on this issue. And so you only read this one.
Yeah, I didn't realize it was the last one. I didn't catch that part. I just thought there's not a lot. And I was like, you know what? I've been meaning to look at this. And why don't I just pick it up in the middle? Because that's how old school comics
would be. And I was going to do it until I read it was the final arc. Right. I was totally going to do that.
That's fair.
So what you've got here is a Cobra Casino. Cobra's gotten into the casino business. Is this the issue where Cobra Commander is a greeter at the casino?
He seemed to be, yes.
Yes, okay. Yes, that made me laugh so hard. Cobra's got a casino where they're doing all kinds of nefarious stuff while making money. And there's a secret genetic lab in the back. And this was expanded more on the previous issue. But they have resurrected Genghis Khan as sort of their new Serpentor. Dr. Mindbender has...
And that was the moment. It was on page one. I was like, O'Connor's got to read this.
They took the homunculus, which is what they like saying a lot, and they imbued it with the soul of Genghis Khan, which we saw in the first issue where he dies, and then we saw his whole soul go to heaven. Mm-hmm. And somehow, I guess, Cobra captured it.
And the best part is that the entire time, every time he does something that's out of place, Dr. Meininger goes, no, I fixed that when I was putting him together. He speaks English now. He knows about modern weapons. Yeah. And I was like, did you notice he's a white guy now?
Right, and also too tall. Genghis Khan was famously short.
I was like, he was definitely an Asian dude.
In the first issue, he was. Different artists, he was drawn differently. So there's been a big battle.
Wait, Dr. Mindbender made him white?
Cobra's an evil organization, Josh. It's what, they're whitewashing history.
So there's a bunch of stuff in here. I actually recognized a lot of it. You know, like, not a whole lot, but like Dr. Mindbender still looks exactly like Dr. Mindbender. Scarlet looks like Scarlet. Like, They don't have movie costumes. Like, no, these are the G.I. Joe toy and cartoon costumes, which is fantastic.
And so this whole thing's just like a lot of running gun battles as there's a small group of Joes, the Scarlet's leading, that is in the casino, but they're pinned down. So there's another group of Joes, an exfiltration team that's like, first of all, too many heavy gunners. They got Rock and Roll and Roadblock and Gung Ho are all this exfiltration team. That's three giant machine guns. You need to mix it up. Where's your medic? And so
they don't need barbecue.
They're also pinned down. And so was it this issue? One of the issues, Scarlet calls for help. So Duke basically sends everyone. Mm-hmm. And this is the final arc. So they're gonna throw the kitchen sink into this arc. So like every Joe is on the way to help rescue Scarlet and her team. So one thing I found out in this, Josh, really shook me to my core.
I know. I know what you're going to say.
So the whole time, so Scarlet's got a bunch of ninjas. She's got Jinx. She's got two characters I don't know called, what were they called? They were Nexus or Nebula. They're two.
Yeah. The lady with
Helix,
the eye
thing. Helix and something else. And then Snake Eyes is there.
Who they keep calling Sean.
They keep calling him Sean. And the whole time I'm like, wait a minute. Did they give Snake Eyes a name finally? Did they reveal his name? And I was like, oh, I hope they didn't do that.
Did you go to the Wikipedia?
I went to the Wikipedia, and I wish they'd just done that. No, Snake Eyes is dead. And not only is Snake Eyes dead, he's been dead for like 7 years. Where was the big story about that? Where was the press release, IDW? I get all your press releases. Where was the one that said Snake Eyes is dead and it's been replaced by a guy named Sean?
But the best thing was, is like, he does some cool shit. Okay, I didn't know this, by the way, because he looks just like Snake Eye.
He's wearing a suit.
He's third gen Snake Eye suit. Right. He's not talking. So I just think, fine. And then at one point, the lady's like, oh, we'll go, me and Sean. And I was like, first of all, even if he isn't Snake Eyes, you don't call him Sean in front of anybody. Because apparently, the whole point of this guy was to fool Cobra into thinking that he was still alive.
Right.
So they need to show a little more name discipline there. Second of all, like at one point, he does some awesome stuff. He goes to fight Genghis Khan, and Genghis Khan's like, you're very good. But you seem like an impersonator.
You're a pretender. Like,
what does that mean?
Yeah.
And I looked it up at that point, and I was like, oh, no. We've missed it.
I looked it up, and I looked at the number it was, and I was like, oh, is that recent? Like, no, it was like 65 issues ago.
You know what was great, though? I just jumped in.
Yep.
And I was like, this is a G.I. Joe issue. And it was Larry Hama, so it felt like old, but he's good enough that it didn't feel... You know, a lot of people who worked on these books... can be kind of hacky. The art isn't great.
No, the art's not great.
It does its job, but it almost works for me in that way.
In one of the issues, I think it was the previous one, Larry Hama got super Larry Hama-y with the descriptions of the weapons.
Nice.
It was like Gung Ho called Roadblock's gun the Ma Deuce, and I was like, there it is. Mm-hmm. And then it was the 40 Mike Mike. I was like, just do it, Larry Hama. Do it all. Give it to me. But then... I found out that Snake Eyes was dead, and I don't know what to do with that information.
I'm angry at myself for like, why wasn't I reading this all along? What what on earth would make me not read this all along? He did 150 more issues,
as many as he did in the original run.
I know, and I didn't read it. I don't know if I was like, I never finished the original one, so maybe I can't. That's stupid.
Yeah,
it was
stupid.
Ridiculous. There's Cobra Commander has a daughter with an eye patch who's named Linda or Laura or something.
Well, he had a son with an eye patch in the original book.
Yeah, yeah. Chris.
What happens at his house? The kids keep losing eyes.
I mean, it's rough growing up in a semi-corporate terrorist conspiracy.
Though, I just want to clarify, and this is going to be on our Best of the Panels. I'm just telling everyone now, you've already seen it if you follow our Instagram. Page 35. Cobra Commander strolling through the casino. Here you go, folks. Complimentary tickets to the floor show. Like, that is the logical extension of Cobra Commander. And on the bottom of the same page, Laura, what's going on? What's the situation at the lab? It's all fine, Cobra Commander. Genghis Khan has the situation under control. Who?
I have no idea. And then is it the Alley Vipers? They all form up in a phalanx?
Yeah.
Like the Greeks?
Yes.
And then they have those awesome like orange and blue shields, and Genghis Khan gets one of those, and he's talking about his fighting style. He's like, a shield can also be a weapon. I was like, this is great. This is bonkers batshit, and it's terrible coloring.
Yeah,
and I
bad.
Don't care.
Yeah. It was fine.
I think this is like Larry Hama took up the budget.
Mm-hmm.
I can't imagine the audience is that big, but they let him do it. So it was like, whatever it takes to get this done.
And I'm going to read the whole finish of the arc. I'm going to finish Larry Hama's story here and see what happens.
Yeah.
So that's all you need to know.
A lot of covers.
So you're still reading Dogs of London. We have one more issue. This is issue 4. 5 is the final issue.
I was surprised to see it on the list because for some reason in my head I thought it had ended. But
no.
Yeah, Dogs of London from Aftershock. Aftershock. Pete Milligan, Artesita on art, the mono.
And you're not reading this anymore.
I am. Yeah. No, I read it.
Okay.
I read it.
It's almost good.
It is really interesting.
Yes.
It's like you're right. It's almost good, but it is compelling enough where I can't quite put my
I never feel bad about having read it, but I'm like, it's almost there. It's not quite there. Here, and this is the issue we find out what happened, which is that these boys, when they were all in juvie or whatever the British version of juvenile, you know, jail is, that they were all experimented on, and the experiments are what allowed them to live. You know, be immortal, basically. Mm-hmm. The ones that he got dug up in the first issue. Why no one notices these three guys walking around the streets of London without pupils is beyond me.
As we all know, anybody would know that if you see somebody with no pupil in your eyes, what's the rule, Connor?
Just put your head down and keep walking. Pretend like it didn't happen.
They're pure evil.
So you get the stories about, you know, sort of abuse in prison and whether or not a person can actually change, because the one guy who is, you know, an old man now who was part of the gang, he's not necessarily bad, but you never really lose it. I mean, it's all interesting and almost good.
I think that I think that if you wouldn't know a problem, if it swim up and bite you in the ass. I think that one of the things that is a strength about this is that the main character and his wife and even some of the people around them are fairly interesting and complex characters on their own. Mm-hmm. And I think that that gives this a lot of weight that lets you get past some of the other parts. But that main character, he's fascinating. Like, he comes, there's a whole like flashback where he's in swinging 60s London and he would go to, and this happened, you know, he's at parties with Mick Jagger.
All right.
And this is all stuff that happened with the craze and the people around them, is that it was kind of cool for a while until it got to be a little too real for those people.
It even happened here in the 60s with like the Rat Pack hanging out with mobsters.
But I think it was much more upfront.
I think that was just the 60s thing. It was just like, how do you invite Benny Siegel to your fucking party, you know, in Hollywood. It just was a cool thing to have these guys who were on the edge. Anyway, it's not bad. It's just, it could be better. Dogs of London. Uh-huh. So while I was gone, you and Ryan talked about Ant-Man number one, and I was listening to that show, and I said, oh, that sounds interesting. I wasn't planning on reading it, but I went and read it, and then issue 2 came out this week. Al Ewing and Tom Riley and Jordy Belair of Ant-Man, and this was less fun only because I don't really care about Eric O'Grady. I never read a book with Eric O'Grady in it.
You never read Irredeemable Ant-Man back in the day? I liked that book. It was Kirkman with Hester and Parks.
Yeah.
It just wasn't, it wasn't what I expected. I remember being, I was really into Kirkman's Marvel stuff at that time. I read this, but as I was doing it, I don't think I actually read the first issue. I think he talked about it because I had no recollection of this.
You both discussed it, the story points and the art.
I honestly don't remember it.
It took place in the 60s and Wasp was there. You loved Wasp in the book. You liked the book.
I'm not disagreeing with you.
Did you have a stroke?
In a way.
Maybe you had a very targeted stroke that took out only the memory of reading that book. So you definitely read it.
That's fine. I'm not disagreeing with you, but I genuinely was like, I don't. But it wasn't hard for me to pick up. I know what this were. I think the stuff I liked about it was, I think the art was fantastic. Tom Riley really channeled that Phil Hester thing. I think that like he's basically
his first issue was much more 60s style. This is more of a Hester style.
I love the Ant-Man movies, and they're very Ant-Man focused. And I find that when we read superhero comics now, and Hank Pym is in or whoever, it's not much Ant-Man action. We don't actually get to do Ant-Man stuff. And this is just Ant-Man. There's ants. He gets small. He fights Hank Pym, who is a Skrull. This is very Marvel-y.
Well, this takes place. The first issue was in the 60s. You know, the malleable time of Marvel. This takes place during right before Secret Invasion. So
right.
The Hank Pym here is a Skrull, and He lets us know it all the time.
I think the Jordy Belair coloring really lends it some quality. I think it makes the art even a little bit better. I thought there was fun stuff in this as sort of just a little Ant-Man story that doesn't have to break the world. The only thing that I didn't like is that, like, at some point they can't not do it, but it's just like, yep. Yeah, but you beat your wife. And I was like, come on, just, it's such a bad thing for the character. Like, it's a misstep on the character that targets him in a way that, like, is irredeemable.
What's interesting, and I don't, because you talked about this in the first issue too.
Yeah.
Is you wrote, very famously wrote an article on iFanboy about that very subject that was like one of the, you know, longest comment threads we ever had. We had to shut it down. Mm-hmm. I think you took the opposite tact in that one. I don't remember. Those long.
It's very possible.
You grow and change.
As well one should. But I think
not that you were pro-domestic abuse.
No, but
you
again,
were like
it's
saying,
not real.
Like, get over it. This is part of his character. It's part of his story. You have to deal with it. Like, I think that's what you said. I don't remember putting words in your mouth.
And I you know, comics the way it is, but I kind of just feel like it's one of those things, like, just let that one go, like the baby Parker, like whatever's in the closet. I want Hank Pym to be... I don't mind like his little psychotic break era when he's Yellow Jacket and he's a jerk, like we talked about with Avengers Forever.
Yeah.
But you don't like you can't beat up Janet Van Dyne and get away with it.
Right.
Like he's out then, even if it wasn't. And it's a step too far for a character. And because of that, like, I don't even know, is Hank Pym even alive now?
Sure.
In Marvel, like I feel like I haven't seen him forever.
Yeah, I don't know either.
But he's got the Scarlet Letter on him.
Are you still reading the variants?
No.
This is the Jessica Jones book written by Gail Simone, drawn by Phil Noto. I wanted to mention it because, so at this point, we got four Jessica Joneses running around from different dimensions. And, you know, it's fine. I'm enjoying it fine. There's not really a lot happening, if we're being honest. But there's two things I think we're talking about. One is they're not all the same kind of Jessica Jones. Like, I know they're all from different dimensions, but they're not all like the same age. Like, one of them is young. She's when Jessica Jones was still Jewel, the character Jewel, not the singer.
Mm-hmm.
And they're talking, and our Jessica Jones realizes, oh shit, this me has never met Kilgrave.
Because
at one point Kilgrave gets talked about, and she's like, "What's a Kilgrave?" And she goes, "Holy shit!" And she gives her a big hug. She's like, I don't want to say unspoiled because that's not what I mean. Well, but like, she has not been
traumatized
by Kilgrave. And so she's like, it really floors our Jessica.
That's a great
great scene. Like, she's like, oh my God, you haven't gone through what we, the rest of us, have gone through. And she just gives us a giant hug. And that was a good scene. And so the other thing, we may have talked about this with the first issue or not, I don't remember, but it's related, is that not in any way to minimize, you know, the experience, but there's got to be a story about Jessica Jones that doesn't involve Kilgrave.
Well, see, no, that's interesting.
That's such a limiting.
Yes,
limiting character.
Because it defines her as a victim.
Right. And,
like, and that's her only...
She's been in a lot of comics, usually as a supporting character in the back, like taking care of the baby while Luke's doing something because she's sworn off being superhero. But when the spotlight turns to her, there has to be something else to deal with other than...
She's either Kilgrave. Luke Cage's wife...
Or
the victim. It's a really good point. And as I was thinking, when you were saying, is that I was comparing Jessica Jones to Hank Pym in that, like, but like a part of her character is that, like it is integral.
It changed
to
her
who
from Jewel to who she is now. But and that is important. And don't deny it or ignore it. But also, let's tell a new story. Maybe something else.
Yeah, no, I think
just
it's a really good
anything
point.
Anything else?
Like, her whole thing does. Like, it'd be like if every single story was about how Peter Parker let his Uncle Ben get... Wait, hold on. No, but I think it's a really good point.
Those are the comics we wanted to talk about. I only read eight or nine books this week, and that was when I added on the G.I. Joes, so it was a very small week. But over at patreon.com/ifanboy, the patrons can vote to add a book to the rundown, and those patrons, in an overwhelming fashion, voted for Amazing Fantasy 1000, which was also the pick of the week.
I did not know that when I picked it.
I know.
I was aware that it might be, but...
I know. So let's do ratings on it, since we already talked about it. Ratings on Amazing Fantasy 1000. I'm going to give it a 5 out of 5.
I don't think I can give it a 5 if all the stories aren't 5s.
That's all right. I think the overall feeling I had when reading it was a 5 feeling.
I'm going to go with 4.75.
And obviously we can't stick with it because it's a one-shot special. And look, We're hitting some big Marvel anniversaries. This is 60 for Spider-Man. So let's do this for, you know, let's get our tribute issue to the Fantastic Four, and, you know, let's get them all in.
I think you got to give credit to the editor, whoever sort of got these stories together and made sure that the right ones were going in here.
Oh yeah, for sure.
It covered a great gamut of stuff. You know, kept you interested the whole way through, and it was unexpected. A lot of it was sort of unexpected kind of stuff. So,
but well done. No more of these numbering shenanigans from Marvel. They're really the worst offenders.
It's just the world as I accept it now. I can't.
Patreon.com/iFanboy. Any patron votes on the book to the rundown, but if you give it the $5 or higher level, you get a superpower live on the show. Josh's turn to bestow it.
Adam Bushell. Can fix any major problem.
Hmm.
But only for an hour.
Okay.
So, this guy is going down to Mississippi. He fixes the water.
Right. But the water's only fixed
for an hour. But from that time, people can see that it can be fixed, how much better it would be if it was fixed. And right. They could even learn how to fix it because he gets it fixed one way or another. And so it can light the way. He could fix global climate change.
For an hour.
For 1 hour. And then it's a big deal, and it shows you what you're missing. Because the thing is, you know, when stuff changes badly slowly, you don't realize what a difference it is.
Right.
You know, if you have like a debilitating injury or something like that that takes years to happen, you get used to it. You live with it, you know, but you get a fix for an hour or so. You're like, I can't believe I'm living like this. And then maybe that makes you change the thing. That's what his story is. That's his CBS hour long drama story.
So you get a flat tire. He fixes your tire, but an hour later, it's going to blow again.
I mean, he could use it for that kind of thing. I was thinking about bigger things, but yes.
I understand that, but he could go. I'm just asking.
He could get you home.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Or, you know, there's a tornado comes back. He can fix your house for an hour.
Yeah.
All right. He's like a different kind of hour man.
Exactly. His whole thing is pretty much wrapped into moral and practical lessons, though.
Patreon.com/iFanboy. That's where you can give the $5 or higher level and get a superpower on the show, like Adam. And again, I'll mention, you know, we're getting close to getting live with the patrons after all these years. It's been like 5 years during these powers. But if you have someone who over the years has given, and not recently, not in the last 6 months, but prior to that, have either upgraded your power, your contribution to over $5, or gave it $5 and never got your power, please email us, contact@ifanboy.com, because we could have missed you. Patreon is a complicated beast, and so if we've missed your power, please email us, and we will add you to the list. We'll get it done. That all happens at patreon.com/ifanboy. It's the best way to help the show. Those are the people that keep us going, keep the bills paid, keep the time being worth it, and also unlock great things that everyone gets to enjoy. All the different shows we do, the Splodes, the family of Splode shows, Talk Splode, Book Splode, Media Splode, all those shows are unlocked by the patrons. The videos on YouTube, all, you know, other things that I've forgotten. The patron hangout, I think that was a stretch goal. Like, all those things were all unlocked by the patrons. We have other goals we're going to get to them as soon as things get less hectic from the personal lives. We'll have some time to actually sit down and look at that. But, you know, one day we'll have a quarterly barbecue show. Or maybe one day we'll get to meet up at conventions again. Who knows? All those things are stretch goals. Patreon.com/iFanboys, where they all happen. So we thank everyone's a patron. Even if you're a $1 patron, you do really make a difference, and we do appreciate it. iFanboy.threadless.com is where our t-shirts are found. I mean, our designs are on other things, but mostly on t-shirts. That's what people buy for the most part. 12 designs on there, including our most recent design, the Gosh shirt, the good old superhero shirt, which was appropriate for mini comics this week. So thanks for buying t-shirts. iFanboy.com/support is our digital tip jar. If you just want to throw a couple bucks in the tip jar, or a couple million bucks if you're an eccentric billionaire, and think it would be funny. It would be really funny. Tell your friends that your next eccentric billionaire hangout poker game where you smoke Cuban cigars and eat endangered meat. Say, I just gave this podcast $10 billion. Isn't that funny, guys? Ha, 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 ha. Very funny, sir. Fanboy.com/Amazon. That's where you can shop. You can find our Booksplode books. You can shop there, and you can help the show out that way. Finally, bookshop.org is our partner. And when appropriate, on the website, you'll find links to shop for books via bookshop.org, which is a great organization that helps independent bookstores in the United States. And I'm a supporter. I buy my books through them. It's a great way to help stores. So thanks to all the people who help us out and support the show. It really does help keep us going. It helps pay the bills. And thank you. And guess what?
Do it.
We have email time.
We do.
I was a little worried there for a second between Amazing Fantasy and G.I. Joe, but we're getting there.
I told you. I said, read G.I. Joe. You were worried about time. I said, read G.I. Joe. We'll get 10 minutes. I wasn't wrong.
Corey from Cleveland, Ohio says, I've been thinking about this question since May 2nd, 2008. With all the time we don't get to see what the characters are doing in the Marvel Cinematic Universe movies, how has Kevin Feige and Marvel Comics not put out an official Marvel MCU-centric series? I've always wanted to see what more missions the Avengers went on between each movie. What were the remaining heroes doing during the blip, etc.? Seems like it's a recipe to print money.
Okay. So I would have my reasons why it probably doesn't exist. And they would be these. One, comics and movies, comics and studios are unrelated, and I don't think comics would want to take any thunder away from something they might do in a movie or a TV show at some point. They don't want to use that
up. I think
up.
That's the number one reason, is
yes.
that the last thing a filmmaker wants to do is be beholden to something some comic writer did.
Yeah.
You know, they want to be able to have the freedom to tell whatever story they want, which is why I always laugh when people say, well, this isn't Star Wars continuity. Well, it is until they hire somebody who doesn't want to do it.
Right.
But it's that way.
There's that and the fact that, I mean, like, the comic book audience is so infinitesimal compared to movies, and there's not necessarily a crossover. I think if one thing we've learned through all this since before May 2nd, 2008, which was when Iron Man came out, if you can catch that reference, is that comics don't drive, or movies don't drive comic book sales. They can sell some trades depending on what it is, but they don't send people into comic shops. They don't lead issues. Like, they do, but not in a significant way, not in a way that changes anybody's lives. You know,
right?
That's over. So it's the reward is small potatoes, and you know, Feige's got to put his energy into this other thing. And,
yeah,
and
he's not gonna. I mean, he oversees a lot of stuff, probably more than people realize. But
yes,
I just think mainly they want to the studio. I mean, this is all speculation. We're all just speculating here.
Sure.
I think the studios people want to run their movies and their TV shows, and they don't want to worry about comics infringing on that in any way, in any possible way. Like, you know, a writer tells a story. This is what Bruce Banner was doing between the movies. And then suddenly that infringes on the She-Hulk TV show. Like, they don't want to do that. And so then what you're left with is a bunch of comics that are just basically the ones you're already doing monthly anyway.
Or they're just they're just references to other things than they are on their own. They're not great stories. I mean, here's the other thing. I don't want those comics.
Yeah.
At all. One of the problems that I think we have in pop culture is the constant filling of every hole. Every little mystery has to be revealed and solved and whatever. You know, the movies
leave it
to
your imagination.
They exist in this way that is super fun, but at least there's space in them now.
Yeah.
That doesn't exist in comics, and I think that is the thing that makes them better. You don't realize it, but you know, if I'm thinking back, you know, Connor and I as you know, Star Wars kids, it was better when we didn't know everything and we had to speculate about it and there wasn't somewhere that explained everything. And yes, it was super, super fun when they started to do that. You know, when those 90s Star Wars novels came out and we were like, oh my God. But, you know, too much of a good thing is too much of a good thing. And I think you got a point, but I think the reward would be a lot less than you think it. It would be, I think comics like this would be ultimately underwhelming. Because it's not the same.
You'd also be stuck with the characters you've got. Like, they could never introduce anybody new. Because, again, that'd be infringing upon the filmmakers. You know, like, you couldn't have gotten, like, the Avengers fighting Namor or Doctor Doom, because they got to let the filmmakers do that.
I mean, what I want is a great story that's told in the medium that it was designed for.
Yeah.
You know, I want the experience. I don't want, you know, the infinitesimal detail. Like, I don't know. I know why people like it, and I've definitely been in the position where I am, and sometimes it works great. But on the whole, eh.
There's also so much Marvel Cinematic Universe stuff right now.
There's, by the way, the last thing that he wrote, this seems like there's a recipe to print money. If you know a recipe to print money in print comics, then you should call someone, because literally, nobody in comics knows what to do with it right now.
I mean, they're making money. They're definitely making money.
They're making money. They're having great sales. A lot of small publishers are doing great. But picking out the formula, it used to be, hey, Jim Lee's going to draw this, 300,000 comics.
But I also would say that licensed books have never been a recipe to print money, even from the big two. Like in the 90s when comics were selling like gangbusters and the Batman the Animated Series was huge on TV, nobody bought that book. Nobody bought the tie-in book. It was great. It was a legitimately great comic. But nobody bought it because licensed books have never really sold.
They're different audiences.
Yeah.
They're just different audiences. The people who are going, people who watch the movies are not the people going into the shops. Now, the people going to the shops are also going to the movies, but it doesn't work the other way around.
They want to read the books that count. Anthony
you
said, from...
Do you remember, like, literally, you know, we're 20 plus years and more than 86, you know, they sold some Batman comics back then, but we're nearly 40 years into this idea, like, well, this will drive people into the shops. And I think everybody understands now that that finally isn't going to, because we used to complain, you know, in the early 2000s, we were doing iFanboy actually through, you know, like, oh man, they should give away comics in the theaters. And it's like, they've done it.
Yep.
It doesn't, it's not a thing. I'm sorry.
Enjoy it.
Yeah.
This next email is going to be for all our billionaire listeners. Josh, why don't you read it in an accent, since you haven't done an accent in a long time.
I haven't? All right. Anthony from Maine says, I listened to a podcast that explained how billionaires avoid paying income taxes. Warren Buffett justifies his by saying he spends his money philanthropically to the benefit of a nation more smiley than the U.S. government could. You think Bruce Wayne, Tony Stark, and Oliver Queen pay their fair share of taxes because they believe it's the right thing to do? Or do they avoid paying taxes, justifying that as allowing them to spend more money on their superheroics and whatnot, and those are the teams that they're on? How'd that, was, did that work
that
out for
great.
You?
That was great.
Okay, thank you.
That was great. I think that, I actually thought about this earlier today, after I saw the script.
Wait, how long?
I mean, just a few, I haven't had the script for days. It was only a few minutes.
Oh. You do what you can.
I don't think Bruce Wayne or Tony Stark or Oliver Queen cheat on their taxes, although Tony Stark might. But I also don't. I think they have people that are minimizing their tax liability, which is
sure.
Which is what everyone does.
Everybody, no even people with money. Like even good people, like that's what you do. What my instinct with this was that like. In these worlds, these guys have so much money that it doesn't matter.
Sure.
Like, oh, yeah. That to me...
Like every billionaire.
Right. Like, but even this, like, Batman has more money than the richest person on Earth in our real world.
Oh, you think he's more than $100 billion?
Oh, I think he's inexhaustibly wealthy. He's Saudi family.
Interesting.
Rich. That's how I think
they say he's like in the single billion digits, like six or seven or eight billion.
I know, but if you look at it, educate yourself, Connor. Read up, watch some YouTube videos.
All right.
I mean, like the money that he's spending is pretty significant. He's doing his own jet research and manufacture on a one-off, you know, basis. I think that with these guys, you have to accept the fact that unless this is the story you're telling, which is almost always bad, money's not a problem. Like the amount,
right,
like
you
never want to do the math on the money. Just like you don't want to do the math on the ages and the you know the whatever. It's just,
so, I think they're paying their taxes.
Yep.
But like everyone, they've got a whole, you know, the Wayne Foundation has a whole accounting team. That's job is to minimize tax liability because that's
and
what
I
their
bet
job
that,
is.
I bet though that would be largely about. Maximizing the philanthropic things that the Wayne Foundation.
Oh, sure,
do,
the Wayne Foundation
also
entire just a giant tax shelter. Foundation,
but it actually, because he's a good dude, it actually does good.
Okay.
I also suspect that I'm thinking this out as if I was writing it. I also think that all of the Bruce Wayne Batman money has to be so disconnected from the Bruce Wayne family money that there almost isn't a link.
You mean the Lucius Fox money?
Yeah. Like, you couldn't have... Someone figure it out.
Right. He can't be raiding the Wayne Foundation money to pay for another creative batarangs.
Right.
He can't
be
doing that.
That has to be a separate thing. Which leads to the question, what ethical investments would Batman be able to make to continue... Okay. He has to be cooking the books somehow.
Well, that was the whole plot in Dark Knight. with the accountant who figured out he was Batman.
Right, but
because he was cooking the books.
Right, so he has to. There's no way. Okay, Frank Miller's ahead of me by
that was Christopher Nolan.
Oh. You're right. Okay. So that's not canon. So let's say in this world, though, in comic, like, there's no way you can do that without cooking the books. So therefore, he is defrauding the government to some extent.
They're doing shady business just to keep their identity secret, for sure.
Yes.
Although everyone knows Tony Stark's Iron Man, so he doesn't need to do that.
And Oliver Queen is good, too, isn't he? Isn't Oliver Queen known?
No, I don't think so. Not anymore.
I don't think they spend much time on Oliver Queen as a person outside.
Well, Oliver Queen now is since Bruce Wayne is quote unquote broke, Oliver Queen is now the guy who funds everything. So it's always like, it used to be with Batman paid for everything. Now it's Oliver Queen.
Yeah, but he doesn't seem limitless because he talks about it. Like, he's the guy who's going, you know, I'm paying for all this. So there is some notion of it. Yeah. There's no way he's that, you know, I guess in that way. And I think it is philanthropic in its way, but he's definitely not paying his fair share directly to the federal government.
Sure.
You couldn't be. I bet Stark is.
Yeah, he probably cheats a little bit.
Yeah, but it's more like because it's a fun game.
It's a game.
He wouldn't go to jail for it. He's not breaking laws.
He's Iron Man.
I don't think Tony Stark is breaking laws, but I think that Bruce Wayne is breaking laws.
I don't think he is.
He has to. He'd have to. You're talking about, you know, minimum billions and billions of dollars going to this other thing. Like, that has to be secret. I don't see how you do that without...
Well, it just depends on whose money is. I mean, also, I don't think in... Oh, my God, I can't believe we're having this conversation.
Oh, my God, it's so good.
I don't think in the comics that Bruce Wayne's companies are public like they are in the movies. Like, the movies, then you're talking about tons and tons of SEC...
That's an
SEC
excellent
violations.
Point.
I think it's a private company in the comics. But even then... He'd have to keep his personal money separate from his company money. Right. He's definitely keeping it separate from the foundation money. So he must have three tranches. Although I don't, you know, if he's the primary, you know, owner of the Wayne Enterprises, he could pay himself whatever he wants in order to cover the, you know, his Batman bills.
Okay, so let's say, and we're not accountants.
No.
By the way, there was a real point here where we stopped doing the show, and we are working
on. We're still recording.
We're working on this problem. Time be damned. All right, so let's say the Wayne Foundation, we'll just break this into simple numbers, makes $1 billion. The company keeps $800 million.
Not the foundation, Wayne Enterprises.
All right, whatever, Wayne Enterprises. Right. It keeps, you know, we'll say 50%. It keeps, you know, 50 million of it, 500 million. And then Bruce Wayne gets paid.
Wait, keeps it from what?
Like, keeps it as their profit or revenue.
Well, taxes is only 20%.
Right. And they pay the tax on that or whatever. Right. But then the salary that gets paid out to Bruce is, you know, $200 million.
Right.
Once Bruce gets his $200 million and then he pays his taxes on that individually,
right?
Can he spend that money on anything he wants without having it betrayed? I know, but like does he have to keep any documentation of what he spends that money on?
No more than anybody else does.
All right. So there
whatever he pays himself as the... basically sole owner of Wayne Enterprises, he can do whatever he wants. He can buy as many batarangs as his heart desires.
Right, but if for some reason the IRS came after him...
Well, this is the whole stupid reasoning behind Lucius Fox now having the money, is that the government might figure out you're Batman now because they're watching you.
Right.
So it's stupid.
You can't think about it too much.
No.
That's basically where we're at, because it ruins it.
But, you know, they pay their taxes. Fair share. Who's to say what's fair?
That's a wicked good question, Anthony.
Contact@manboy.com is how Anthony wrote in. Thanks for writing in. You can write in for this show or for the Media Splode show. If it's for Media Splode, please put your name, put Media Splode in the subject title and don't have it be about comic books or anything related to comic books because it's a non-comics show. Let's talk about this month, September. We have two, I think we only have two extra shows this month. I'm not positive, but I think we only have two.
If you're lucky.
We have our Media Splode show coming out either this week or next. We haven't really figured that out, but it's going to be our Old Man on Old Movies episode reviewing the Poseidon Adventure from 1974. What year was American Graffiti?
Two.
So this is 1973 because it's the year after, which means next month we'll do a 1975 movie. I know for sure the Poseidon Adventure came out a year after American Graffiti.
Okay, so American Graffiti. American Graffiti is actually 73. I was wrong.
So then 74 is the Silent Avenger. So that'll come out this month, and then maybe it'll be a Toxplode. We'll see. But that'll be the only extra shows. Which means the next big thing to look forward to is October. October 7th will be the pick of the week, 850 live. We'll be recording that live. We'll be doing it over YouTube like we always do. It'll start at 6 p.m. Pacific, 9 p.m. Eastern, probably. That's when they usually start. And that means now, starting now, you can start sending your emails in for episode 850. That means write into contact@ifanboy.com with the subject line 850 to get your email live on the show. And as if you're new to the show and you've been only coming here for the last year, on the big anniversary shows, the 50s and the zeros, we do a no-holds-barred 3-hour-ish all email show. It's so hot. I'll talk about that in a second. So we're looking forward to that. It'll be me and Josh and probably Ryan Haupt, although we haven't talked to him about it yet, but we're looking forward to doing our all-email show live with you watching along in the chat room. We'll be talking about it every week until then. Pick of the week, 850 live, October 7th, 6 p.m. Pacific, 9 p.m. Eastern. Email to us with 850 in the subject line.
Fair enough. You can find all of our shows over at ifanboy.com, as well as the archive of years of great comic book writing from our many varied and talented staff. You can find out what the pick of the week is before the show comes out, the one that you're listening to now. So therefore, you could have found out had you gone to @ifanboy on Twitter, @ifanboycomics on Instagram. You can follow us individually, C.S. Kilpatrick and J.A. Flanagan on Instagram. You can subscribe to our YouTube page, where our entire available video show library is up at youtube.com/ifanboys, and we post this show there every week too. If you were like, man, I don't like listening to this on this convenient device, I'd rather listen to it with a still image on YouTube, well, good news. Although they're starting a podcast thing, so maybe it's going to be better.
You're looking at that.
That's all.
Hey, if you like the show, consider leaving a review or a star rating on Apple Podcasts, which is where most people listen to it, but anywhere you listen to the show, or even if you listen to it on YouTube, give it a thumbs up. Or whatever they do on YouTube. That's how people find the show. It's how the algorithm works. We do appreciate that from everybody who does so. It only takes a moment. Even better than that's word of mouth. Tell your friends and your family and your boss and the guy in the street and anybody you run into, really. Tell them that we sent you and we'd like you to listen. And help spread the word. We do appreciate that. I am dying.
You know what? Put your air conditioner back on before we end the show. So they can understand.
I don't know if anyone realizes this, but it's Southern California is melting. And
so that is what it sounds like.
Yeah.
If you have an air conditioner on.
It's not even blowing out cold air yet. It just started.
To be
just
fair,
blowing
I
hot
can,
air on me.
This is, if I put mine on,
mm-hmm.
You can't hear it because my mic is incredibly good at breaking getting rid of background noise.
Mine is as well. The air conditioner is next to the microphone, so
that's fair. I'm in a larger room.
It's like 105 degrees. I've been sitting here
at night
in a puddle of sweat. I've been feeling drops roll down my chest, down my leg, down my back. It's just been awful. And I just hate this and I hate everything. Not you, though. Or you.
Me?
Josh or the listeners. But I hate the world.
Sure.
When it's hot. Anyway, thanks for listening. I'm Connor.
I'm Josh. Thanks, everyone. When the days are high.